website, cooktolive.org. That's cooktolive.org, all lowercase.
The world tour of Hindu holy woman Amma Sri Karunamayi will be in New York City on Thursday, June 21st and Friday, June 22nd for individual blessings. The blessing program takes place at the Community Church of New York, located at 40 East 35th Street. Blessings are from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and are free of charge, however donations are gratefully accepted. For more information about Karunamayi and her world tour, go to karunamayi.org.
We are locking people up for fighting for 15 while corporate crooks are going free. 8 million poor working people not having health care because of governors and legislators denying Medicaid expansion. 30,000 people are dying every year, not because it was their time to die, but because a governor or a legislature would not give them health care.
You've been listening to Reverend William Barber leading the revival of Reverend King's 1968 Poor People's Campaign. King's triple evils of war, poverty, and racism are as relevant today as then. The campaign is holding a massive rally and march in Washington, D.C., Saturday, June 23rd. WBAI will proudly broadcast it from 1 to 6 p.m., with studio anchoring by Crossroads producer Reverend Sam Cruz and field reporting by Building Bridges, Mimi Rosenberg, and Ken Nett.
Is this where you wait for the bus to Luxembourg?
Yes, I'm taking the bus to Luxembourg.
Well, I'm not going to stay in Luxembourg.
Me either. I'm taking the train to Paris.
Well, me too. Are you going to stay in Paris?
No, I'm flying on to New York.
Well, I'm flying on to New York.
Brooklyn, really?
I'm going to Brooklyn.
What for?
To see John McDonough's Off the Meter at the Brooklyn Common.
Tales of a New York City cab driver.
Saturday night, June 23rd.
Me too.
Oh, really?
The great Malachi McCord is a special guest star.
I know. I can't wait.
Show starts at 7. Tickets are available at WBAI.org.
I got my tickets.
Me too. Off the Meter is a benefit performance for WBAI.
I know. I don't want to miss it.
You won't, but first...
But first what?
Don't miss the bus.
If you miss the bus to John McDonough's Off the Meter, take a taxi.
And, you know, I've heard of bus in Luxembourg. They don't sound like that. You are listening to WBAI New York. It's 8 o'clock, and that means, if it's Wednesday, it's time for Off the Hook. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
Alex.
Good to be back.
Welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
We'll talk about where you were in the minutes ahead. Voltaire.
Hey.
And our special guest, Dent.
How's it going?
Do you have a microphone?
I'm sharing.
Is sharing? Okay, well, we might want to move it a little closer. That way you can hear your voice as well. And here we are on another action-packed edition of Off the Hook. Talking about all kinds of hacker-related things. Hey, I've got a big bit of news that I'd like to share with people. Tomorrow, the Hope site will be displaying pretty much all the talks. Well, maybe 95% of the talks. Maybe 90%. I'm not really sure. A lot of talks. About 100 talks that we'll be having at the Hope Conference. They will be announced tomorrow at hope.net. So get your browsers fired up. I am so amazed and impressed by the caliber of speakers and the variety of talks that we have this year. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be really, really amazing.
I got a question for you. Is it also going to have the schedule, or is it just the
talk? The schedule comes afterwards. Okay. Right now, we just have all the schedule is basically a very complex mathematical formula. that involves balancing things and taking all kinds of other issues into account. But that will probably follow within a week. And plus, it has to be approved by multiple people and all that kind of thing. But we figured, why hold back on what we've got reserved so far? So it's really going to be amazing. So sometime tomorrow, probably early afternoon, hope.net, you will see what we have scheduled.
Yeah, so far I've been sort of taking your word for it. I'm really excited for everyone else to be able to share in that after we release some of that information, so that people know what the content of the conference is going to be like and get sort of an idea of where their interests are and what they really, really want to check out and so on.
Absolutely. So, Alex, you were overseas, I believe?
Yes, your belief is correct.
Okay. Your email is bouncing all over the place, by the way. Listeners have complained to us about this. Yeah, if you write to us, eventually you'll get a bounce message from Alex's provider because they don't know what they're doing, right?
That's true. Okay. It's a 101 domain, and they are being a real pain.
Wow. There's nothing wrong with your computer or with Off the Hook or anything like that. It's just Alex's provider.
That's right. Me and my Icelandic domain name.
Icelandic domain name. Wow.
Well, anything that, you know, it ends in .is, so, you know, you have to make that clear. It's Icelandic. It's not the Islamic State.
Okay. Well, maybe you get the Icelandic football team to handle it. They can't do anything wrong, so maybe they can handle this as well.
Or the chess team.
Yeah, they have such a thing. So where you were overseas, I believe you were in the same place that Kyle and I were at a year ago in Italy.
That's right. I was in Milan. I was at the Radio Popolare conference,
okay.
And it was absolutely fantastic. It was actually, I think, a really big change from what you had experienced the year before, because my understanding is that you guys were actually in the Radio Popolare studio.
Yes.
And this year, it was not in a studio. It was a gigantic party that was held outdoors at a beautiful park next to a disused psychiatric hospital in Milan.
You see, I've spent a lot of time outdoors in big parks next to psychiatric centers. I've seen that. But the studio is really awesome.
Is that right?
Did you not see the studio?
I didn't see the studio at all. I mean, they made the outdoors. They made the whole park the studio.
Well, yeah, they can do that. They can just make anything into their studio. But they have this amazing setup, and they have all this listener support. And it's something that I think we can learn so much about.
I mean, I thought about this, you know, the entire time I was over there. Is so much to learn from Radio Popolare and how they energize the community, how they bring the listeners together, and, you know, the way that they support the station, and I think we've gone over this several times on the air, is basically like the WBAI buddy system that we have here, so that they know they have a certain amount of income coming in every year. They increase that listener base every year, and they can do cooler and cooler things, like throwing a gigantic outdoor party in a park next to a disused psychiatric hospital. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, the last day there, Marina Cattucci, who's a friend of our station here, she did a live outdoors version of their famous show called Sunday Blues. She and actually another participant on which I was on a panel, apparently the Sunday Blues show is really popular because they talk about kind of irrelevant things. You know, it's just anything that floats up into their mind. It's a really popular Sunday evening show. They did this outdoors. They had a band out there. They had the entire community incredibly engaged. And one of the things I thought was really cool was that there was this older woman who seemed to call into almost every show on Radio Popolare, and they brought her up on the stage, and she was, you know, a celebrity for a day because everybody that listens to that station knows her. They have never met her in person, and there she was out there on the stage, live on the radio, without being on the telephone. I mean, I think if we had a party with WBAI, you know, we'd have to have, I guess, somebody like Tom from the Bronx coming up on stage. You know, and being a part and meeting people and energizing the entire crowd. It was just it was a really, really great experience.
Yeah, I was going to suggest Tom from the Bronx as well. Yeah. I wonder if he speaks Italian too.
He might. You never know. But it was a really fascinating couple of days over there. The first panel that I was on had to deal with cybersecurity, privacy, what's going on under the Trump administration, what rights are under threat. We talked a lot about net neutrality and how that will possibly impact Europe and what's going on to resist this in the United States. But before the panel was scheduled to go on the stage, the mayor of Milan was speaking, and at the end of his particular talk, just sort of randomly, you know, about 15, 20 protesters appeared in the audience, holding up signs, chanting, yelling, screaming, and they were complaining a lot about squatters' rights. And the issues that they were apparently addressing, from what my limited understanding of the language, was that they were living in these buildings that were also disused, sort of like the psychiatric hospital next to the party. And and law enforcement of Milan was kicking out these families, and a lot of them were immigrant families, and they were poor families. Even though these buildings were supposedly earmarked for these particular families, they weren't being used, and there were a lot of issues. And this went on for a long time, you know, about 15 minutes or so. And then the organizers came over to us and said, well, you know, your panel's going to be delayed because of this particular protest going on. And with the mayor there, and I guess with members of the city council present, the organizers of the Radio Popolare conference decided that they would actually give the protesters time on the stage to speak their piece so they didn't have to yell and scream over everybody. And I thought this was just an incredibly civilized way of addressing these issues, because here in the United States, the police would have been called, and if they didn't stop, people would have very likely been arrested. But instead, in Milan, they gave them the stage, and they got up there, and they spoke for probably about 7 or 8 minutes. It was a man and a woman that got up and made their piece very passionately and very directly about what they thought was wrong with this particular policy. And the whole audience was incredibly engaged. And then afterwards, my understanding is that they actually met with the city council and were discussing these issues for about an hour and a half, possibly 2 hours, which is a just incredible outcome when you think about how this could have turned out differently if that had happened here in New York.
Mm-hmm. Or anywhere in the States, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it was an eye-opening experience. I loved that that happened right before our panel went on because, you know, I just sort of thrive on pandemonium and chaos,
mm-hmm.
Much like you guys do, I would imagine. And totally different experience, I think, than you guys got the year before in studios. That was something you didn't experience.
I suspect it's a different experience every day at that place.
I would imagine so. I would imagine so. But it was fantastic. We got to spend a couple of days outside the city over at Lago di Garda and Lake Como. And, you know, it was tough to come back to New York, let me tell you.
It really was an inspiring experience for us, and to just experience the station, be invited, and see how they thank their own members and supporters. So that actually had been partly why we were really pushing along with the station for more BAI buddies, because that system, we saw a great example of that working for a massive station like Radio Popular. And I just like how the running of the station itself is not political, but it can exist and take on the political, and I think that's an important lesson, something we can look at.
I think they have a minimum amount of €100 a year that people donate, and they have so many people that commit to that the station never has to beg for money on the air. And I just wonder, can we achieve that here with the BAI buddy system? I know by having good programming we can get there. That would be amazing. We can look to these people to inspire us.
Well, I'll tell you, based on the party that I was at, I think that, you know, the listeners are going to be extremely energized and extremely generous to the station because they really brought people together. You know, one interesting observation I had about the sort of demography of the listeners that were there was that you had a lot of young people, I would say in their early 20s to sort of late 20s, and then a lot of older people in the sense of, you know, let's say over 60 or so, and not a lot in between. So it was an interesting absence of people, let's say, in like their mid-30s and 40s. And I thought this was interesting because it seems like it was such an important dialogue to have between younger people and older people at this particular station. You know, maybe us in our late 30s and early 40s don't really necessarily matter all that much, but it just seemed like there was a lot of communication going on between generations that was brought together because of the radio station, and that was incredibly cool.
Yeah, it's also a phenomenon we have in the States within activist circles where an organization I'm part of, Democratic Socialists of America, they have the memberships are either like hippie generation or like millennial. They're growing up with Bernie Sanders, so it's very similar here.
Interesting. But it was a fantastic way to bring all the listeners together. If we could do something like this at WBAI, it would be because of the WBAI buddy system, because you can count on that particular revenue coming in over a certain period of time, which is why it's so incredibly important to support the station like that when we ask for it.
Give to WBAI.org is the website, so go there and help bring us a little bit closer to how they do things overseas. Hey, I want people to hear something right now. That piece was created by Dent here in the studio. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Wow. That was really cool. Yeah, if we haven't mentioned it before, Dent is a musician, and he's actually working on what do we call it? Intermission music at the conference. And
Inspired by the Pausen music in Germany, but basically it allows us to distribute our videos without having any copyrighted music, and we asked Dent if he was interested in composing some stuff. We had sort of a contest or people contribute stuff before, and this time he expressed some interest. So these are really great. I mean, this is really interesting. This is unlike anything I've heard of your work. So thank you for offering or helping us do this.
Is that one of the intermission pieces, or do you have something else lined up for that?
Well, basically, my creative process just consists of making as much as I can and then cherry picking what's the best for certain events.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Well, I think that piece, I'd kind of want to stay and listen to it. Maybe I wouldn't move. Maybe I wouldn't leave the room.
Would you still describe your stuff as more like experimental? I mean, do you like that as a comfort? Labels in general are kind of fraught with problems, but yeah. Would you say you're into like experimental composition? Or
I'd say so. I mean, I always had trouble like finding a certain genre to put it in, so I guess experimental's the oddball category.
Kind of gives you a wide range. Cool.
Let's hear another one. If I can get this program to work. There we go. See, this one I could see working, getting people to, march in an orderly fashion from one room to another as the talks change. Is that what you had in mind when you wrote this?
Yes. This is a marching song.
A marching song, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, a little disorienting, too. That's perfect.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would like to have this playing during my talk. Is that possible?
You want to have music playing during your talk? Dent, is it too late to have an hour-long piece commissioned for Alex's talk?
We could just do this on loop. This would be perfect. Uh-huh.
Yeah, how about every single talk has its own theme? That's
a
great idea.
That would be a great idea.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Got to start planning a little earlier, guys.
easy stuff, right?
Wow. See, we've done this in the past, and we've been inspired by our friends over in Germany who've had really good music between tracks. I think we just keep getting better and better, and this certainly is indication of how we're progressing.
Yeah, it adds to the production value. It makes sort of the transition from a formal sort of academic or other kind of presentation to sort of talking and sort of an actual intermission activity, milling about.
What kind of equipment do you use?
It's just my laptop.
You do this on your laptop?
Yeah.
Wow. And I feel if I can, you know, block an ad on Firefox, I've accomplished something. And look what this guy's creating. That's amazing.
Yeah. Are you using some of your own samples, though, as well? Like, are you recording ambient or natural sound? Or do you draw from different sources to get your instrumentation?
One of the files in there is some sample I did, but I don't know which one it is. But, yeah, most of what I sample is, like, old music that I really like, and certain parts of it I just want to, you know, make it into something else.
Great. No, that's really cool. So,
what software do you use to edit it?
I use Ableton to produce everything, start to finish, yeah.
Wow. What's it called again?
Ableton Live. Ableton Live 9, specifically.
I've never heard of that.
That's, wow. I think, a sequencing or some kind of music composition.
Yeah.
There's like, the top, like, three or four applications that people use, right?
There's the big ones, which are, like, Ableton and Logic and FL Studios, and then some people use, like, Cubase and stuff. There's a whole bunch of programs.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to one more, then we're going to get into some stories and maybe even some phone calls. So you're not offended if I talk over this, are you?
No.
Are you done? Okay, I don't like offending artists. Yes.
This is extremely cool, and it sounds great. Do you have, you know, formal musical training?
Sorry.
So did you study music? Do you have formal training in music?
Yeah, I've been playing piano since I was five, and I picked up other instruments, and producing was just another thing I did.
Five?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It took a while, but I learned.
It took
stuff.
A while, yeah. Right? Of course. Oh my God.
He's 7 and a half now, so it hasn't been that long. All right.
This is just an amazing display of what the hacker community is capable of producing. People with such talent, musically, program-wise, and I think it's represented in the talks that we'll be presenting at the conference. You'll see all kinds of skill sets from people of all ages. So that's really amazing. Now, Alex, you had a point here.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, the part of the reason why we have this music is to have something sort of during an intermission without running into copyright violations.
Yeah, because what happens is we post it on YouTube, and then all of a sudden, you know, Van Halen or somebody is claiming credit for the music we're playing in between. Not that we ever played Van Halen between, although I did get people out of the room.
Or would we?
Yeah. But the point is, you know, not to have that hassle to worry about, but also to create something from the community, something local, something, you know, truly unique.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that because, you know, there have been some rather interesting copyright developments just today when it comes to copyright law and content filtering on the internet. I don't know if you've heard about this Article 13 nonsense in the EU.
This is the scheme from the EU
That's right, yeah.
Can you describe that a little bit? What is exactly, what's going on? What are they implementing?
Well, it's an extremely controversial proposal that was voted on today by this committee called JURI, J-U-R-I, which is essentially the Legal Affairs Committee of the European Union Parliament. And this Article 13 proposal required something really crazy and beyond the pale, and it actually passed. What it does is would require, now if this goes to a plenary vote of the European Parliament, which would be the next step, and if it passes, this would be memorialized, my understanding is, in a directive that would be then applicable to all of the countries in the European Union, and it would require any content that a user uploads to the internet to then be run through some kind of content filtering system to determine whether or not it violates an existing copyright.
Wait, stop. Just stop. Hold on. Now, I know when you post something on YouTube, it goes through all that garbage where it basically, yes. I don't know how they do it, but they very quickly are able to scan the video and the audio and tell you if something is copywritten in one way or another. What you're saying is that anytime you upload anything to the internet, whatever that means, we'll get into that in a second, the same process is going to happen according to this EU directive?
That's exactly right. And Google does this with YouTube quite efficiently through their content ID system. And this would make that particular type of system applicable to possibly every other medium on the internet. It's not clear right now as to which types of businesses or which types of websites it would apply. Some particular sites or some mediums may be exempt from this particular requirement, but that's not at all clear right now at all.
Who's behind this? Who's pushing this?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, it's copyright holders. It's people, you know, that represent publishers and authors.
Well, I hold copyright. I'm a publisher. I'm not in favor of this.
Well, this is a
very... Nobody asked me. Of course, I'm also not in Europe, but still.
Well, this is a very interesting point you make, too, because one of the arguments against this is that, you know, like any kind of blocking or filtering technology, it's likely to overblock things that it's not mm-hmm. supposed to block and underblock that which it's supposed to block. So you have situations where you're having an automated algorithm make a legal analysis as to whether something is or is not copyrighted. And if you think about things like 2600, if you don't care about copyright, you know, you don't mind if people distribute things this way or that way.
It's kind of the point of making it so that people distribute it, so that people spread it around and read and listen.
That's right, and that's another point, too. But to go back to my original point, which you interrupted,
I'm sorry.
By the way, is that so these particular types of systems, they may not be able to determine something like, do you remember Bruce Sterling's book, The Hacker Crackdown?
Yes,
way back in the day. It was a great book, really excellently written, great anthology of what happened with
hackers. Stuck it on the internet for free.
Exactly. So that would probably be blocked if it was being distributed, let's say, on a website. Because is this algorithm going to be able to identify a copyright that existed but which is no longer enforced? So copyright holders may have their copyrights enforced against their will, which is a kind of crazy thing to think about.
And they don't benefit in any way from this?
No, not necessarily. And I mean, I couldn't see it. But you bring up one other point, which I think is very important to note, which is that the point of creating these works is so that people can read them and access them and build on top of them, right? I mean, you think about the history of Western civilization, it's about building on top of ideas. You know, everyone stands on the shoulders of giants. It's about criticism, fair use, parity, freedom of speech. All of this may be impeded in the European Union if this actually goes to a plenary vote and passes.
Yeah, these algorithms can't take into account freedom of speech or fair use. So, like with YouTube's content ID, people like things like The Daily Show, they can't exist if you want to create your own because it'll automatically get taken down. Because even if you're using clips as fair use to parody them or something, make commentary, the algorithms can't tell that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there is this, kind of conflict as well that doesn't seem to be necessarily resolved because I think it's Article 15 of the e-commerce directive or the InfoSoc directive of the European Union, which essentially states and is law already that European Union member states cannot put a burden onto internet mediums to police or monitor or filter the content of internet users. So this, if it passes, would seem to be directly in conflict with that particular provision itself. How this is going to be resolved, we're not necessarily sure. There's this weird thing that happens now because this was voted on and passed, I think, by 15 to 10 votes today. So it was somewhat close. But now it was also voted to go through this thing called a trilogue negotiation, which is kind of bizarre. And this is where the European legislators themselves, the members of the European Parliament, will actually meet with the member states and discuss the legislation and try to iron out the details. And if that actually happens, this is much more likely to be passed in a European Parliament than fail. So that's kind of scary to think about. And it's also somewhat undemocratic when you have these types of meetings going on behind closed doors, not subject to public scrutiny. So I think that's kind of scary. But on the other hand, you know, the internet has really been rallying against this. European citizens are really concerned about this because it obviously has impact on freedom of speech, freedom of association, the right to parody, you know, all of the things that you had mentioned, Voltaire, that just aren't taken into account by a particular algorithm. And hopefully, when this comes to a plenary vote, maybe in December of this year, maybe in early 2019 at the latest, it will fail. Let's hope for it. But, real luminaries, people like Vint Cerf, the EFF, mm-hmm. you know, they filed a letter against this, I think, several days ago. And that letter seems to have been ignored, and they brought up a lot of the same issues.
Would they pay attention to the EFF in Europe?
They should, quite frankly, because they, you know, always have a great take on the issues and a good way of slicing away the fat on these particular arguments. Right. You know, they're not just concerned about U.S. citizens' rights. They're concerned about rights of all Internet users. So I think that they would take it into an account, and I think the EFF has a certain amount of influence on European Union citizens as well. And it's really up to them to start mobilizing, because otherwise you're going to have a situation, perhaps, where content providers may deliberately exclude the EU from their services. And that's not good for anybody. That drives businesses out of the European Union. It decreases foreign direct investment in these particular companies. It could have a real backlash.
Yeah, it's another thing, problem with this bill is that it's not just about the mandatory filtering. It also has a link. Article 14 is about the link tax, which requires anybody that posts a clip of a news article to basically pay a tax for that. So that basically will put like small independent blogs and stuff out of business. They can't afford that.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not entirely sure what the vote was on that, or if it was separate and distinct from the Article 13 vote, but I haven't seen a lot about it. But you're right. It was a kind of bizarre thing that I learned today.
You see a theme here, though? The independent people, they're the ones that are always being shut out, and the big corporations are the ones making the decisions. You see it all the time with Google and YouTube, and it's harder and harder to do things independently, such as running a mail server, Alex.
yes.
All kinds of things that you're encouraged not to do yourself, let some big corporation do it. But then when you do that, they impose these rules and regulations and restrictions, and you wind up paying the price for it.
Yeah. Thankfully, there's still time to fight this. So you should, if you're in the EU, you should definitely contact your member of EU Parliament and go to saveyourinternet.eu. To find out more about how to contact your representative.
Now, here's an interesting story concerning Medium and GitHub. Medium, of course, the blogging platform. GitHub is a code repository. They have just suspended posts containing the LinkedIn information of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Those are the people at ICE, the ones that are tearing up families and raiding homes and businesses and things like that. Both the post and the database, which was first removed from Medium and then from GitHub, were created by data artist Sam Levigny. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. Twitter also suspended Russell Nice's bot account that was automatically tweeting information from the database. Now, basically what Levigny did was scrape and download names, job titles, and city-level locations of ICE employees and posted that data to GitHub, which is a website that hosts code repositories and was recently acquired by, guess who, Microsoft. Now, he wrote a blog post about the project on Medium, which linked to the database on GitHub. Now, his project was in response to the increasingly explosive situation at the U.S.-Mexico border, where news reports are emerging daily about children being separated from their parents and detained, and all kinds of other horrors that we're finding out about. Now, what Medium has said is Medium's rules don't allow posts that name specific individuals for the purpose of targeted harassment or shaming. They said the Post violated its rules against doxing or the aggregation of publicly available information to target, shame, blackmail, harass, intimidate, threaten, or endanger. GitHub said in an email that it removed the project because it violates our community guidelines, which includes policies against use of GitHub for doxing and harassment and violating a third party's privacy. Now, the data has since been copied to a publicly available Google spreadsheet, and Google did not immediately respond to a request for comment from BuzzFeed News, which is where the story comes from. Now, in his original blog post, Lemini said the data set he downloaded contains the names of 1,595 people. While I don't have a precise idea of what should be done with this data set, I leave it here with the hope that researchers, journalists, and activists will find it useful. I find it helpful to remember that as much as internet companies use data to spy on and exploit their users, we can at times reverse the story and leverage those very same online platforms as a means to investigate or even undermine entrenched power structures. Now, on Twitter, supporters of his project have spread the link to the data. One said the list should be used to locate ICE employees and deny them employment, services, and friendship. Of course, others feel the scraping and downloading of LinkedIn profile data was unfair to the workers. Now, LinkedIn does not provide an easily accessible API, and they have previously sued individuals who have scraped their data. In a statement regarding the ICE employee data, spokesperson said, "We do not support or condone what immigration authorities are doing at the border, but we can't allow the illegal use of our member data. We will take appropriate action to ensure our members' data is protected and used properly." You know, it's interesting because, first of all, I get so much spam from LinkedIn. It's insane. But if you're on LinkedIn, if you subscribe to them or have your profile on there, seems to me you can share the information you see with anybody you please. Am I right on that, Alex?
No, I think you're right about that. I mean, it's somewhat idiotic for these federal employees who are in sensitive positions to be posting their employment status and their jobs, duties, and responsibilities right on LinkedIn. You know, that's a separate issue, I think. But once you do that, that data does become somewhat fair game. But yet, on the other hand, if it's just LinkedIn data and that's being spread around, that's one thing. But if it's more personally identifying information, then, you know, I tend to agree with Medium and GitHub for taking this down. Because, you know, not every ICE agent that was listed on this was responsible for this type of deplorable behavior on the border when it comes to separating children. And I don't think they all deserve to be doxxed just because they work for ICE.
Yeah, and some Nazis just did paperwork, I know. But right now, they're part of an organization which is doing horrible things, and I think they all should be exposed.
I disagree with that, because I think there are some very good people that work in the federal government.
On both sides?
Yeah, on both sides.
Very fine people on both sides.
There are very fine people on both sides.
Can't be quoted on that, yes.
You know, my point here is that, look, I used to be a federal employee. I used to work in the intelligence community. I wouldn't have appreciated being doxxed when I worked.
We already have all the data on you that we need.
That's true. Yeah, you got it from my mail server. Here comes another joke. Okay, here we go. But my point being, though, is that sometimes it is easier to affect change from within an organization than from without it. It's easier to do
I'm happy to go within it and make change.
I'm sure ICE would love to hire you.
Well, no, I don't plan on being hired. I just plan on being inside their organization and affecting change one way or another.
Look, I see.
There comes a time where you have to step up and do something. Anybody who does something at this point is doing good work.
Not necessarily. Okay, if that's the case then, right, then perhaps what should have been done in a more responsible manner was to do the legwork to identify those people who were stationed at or near the border who had some reasonable likelihood of being involved in this deplorable separation of children from families, rather than posting the names and addresses of ICE agents that might work in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's the same thing with war crimes. These people are protected. The same thing with NYPD. The same thing with the border agents. They're all protected. They can go out and be thugs, and then they come back, and then there's all this blue line crap.
Well, they're not necessarily all thugs. That's my point.
Well,
they work for a thug organization.
Yeah, they work for a thug organization.
And it's a choice.
Yeah. And well, right now, I'm just saying it's time for the other side to strike back. And it just seems like the other side is way too polite, never does anything, is simply filing things in court. Meanwhile, so many people are suffering. It's just nice to see a reaction of any sort. And this is a reaction. Yeah, you know what? You don't want to be associated with ICE. You don't want your name out there. Then don't put it on your LinkedIn profile, which people can read. How about that?
That's a fair point. And that goes back to my original point, which is that it's idiotic for these people to have posted this in the first place.
Yeah, they're not the most clever people in the world, I know.
I agree with that, but they don't necessarily deserve to be harassed in this particular
matter. Nobody deserves to be harassed. Nobody deserves what's going on. That's the whole point.
David Hogg got swatted. I mean, hello.
Calling it a doxing is such a loaded term because this did not include addresses; it just included names. So,
and it was something that was already publicly available. It's like Xeroxing the phone book and putting a check next to people who work for ICE.
Okay, well, look, if it doesn't necessarily include personally identifying information that is over and above that which you can access from LinkedIn, then that's a different situation, I think. But it would require some kind of compilation of sorts. I still think, however, that some legwork should have been done so that these names of people who were posted actually, you know, had a likelihood of being responsible for some of these deplorable actions.
How do we find that out? Do they put that on the LinkedIn? By the way, I'm responsible for separating kids.
Geographic areas. You look at that.
So you're basically saying everybody in Texas is guilty of this, but not people in New York.
I mean, I would support that.
Look, they're all involved in raids of one sort or another. They're all involved in things that that most of us consider reprehensible. So I don't know. We can sort it out. Let's get the names, and maybe we can contact them on the phone and ask them, hey, are you responsible for this? No. Maybe you could like slip a note under the door of your supervisor and say, hey, this really sucks. Stop doing it. I don't know, just little steps.
It's not just these the employees that are associated with the jailing of families that should be disbanded. ICE in its entirety should be disbanded. It hasn't always been around. It's
Voltaire,
only been around
they,
for five
they
years.
They should be melted. Ice should be no. I want bumper stickers that say melt me some ice. You know,
vaporize.
Well, no, because it's ice. You don't vaporize ice. You melt ice.
Yeah,
you ever watch the Wicked Witch of the West?
Okay,
you know,
fine. You go right to steam, though.
Well, look, I'll argue your point for a second, too, on this. You know, when I lived in Vermont, people don't realize this, but
it borders Canada. I know this.
Well, that's true. Uh-huh. But because of Senator Leahy's sway in the Senate and his ability to roll pork back to Vermont, Vermont actually has, and I believe it still has, one of the biggest ice law enforcement support centers in the country, in Williston, Vermont. So,
you have the address of that?
Well, this is where, let's say, if you're a police officer and you make a stop and you want to check the immigration status of somebody, you would call into the law enforcement support center in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And it's those people that would check the immigration status based on an ICE database that's located in Vermont. So,
Williston, you said?
Williston. Okay, that's right. It's just south of Burlington.
Right. And I see it here. I'm looking at satellite view of it.
Got it. Absolutely. It's a nondescript office building.
Oh,
big
there
American
they.
Flag.
Yeah. No, I got it. Yeah. I see the flag. Yeah.
Yep. You got it. Very good. So, look, that this point, arguing my counterpoint, is lending some credence to the idea that, yeah, maybe it's not just people at the border who are involved in this particular type of situation that they're handling.
Oh, I know that.
I would argue if their organization is so noble and worthwhile, why do they have to hide? And why after the fact, you know, in a retroactive way, are they having to hide from, you know, an alleged backlash or whatever? If they're stupid enough to put their information there, yeah, okay, that's going to happen. But not anticipating that and you know, going so far as to hide them because what they're doing is atrocious. I mean, that seems like really convenient. And at the least, I don't know what else to say.
This is more, the story is more about GitHub and Medium, Microsoft, and how they're reacting to data being spread around, not so much ICE. I know that's where we're going with this right now is, you know, why this happened in the first place. But I think that's what's interesting here is that the fact that, hey, this person works for ICE is something that these companies are saying that data belongs to us and you can't spread that around.
Yeah, okay. And this is worth noting that Microsoft owns LinkedIn, and they just recently bought they're starting to purchase GitHub. The deal's not
so they own two of them. Who owns Medium? Does somebody own Medium? That's
no,
huge.
It's self-run, but it's
Yeah, how long is that going to
go bankrupt soon? But anyway, the problem, it's like with it's almost like the, Microsoft has incentivized that GitHub to take it down, and they had ramifications for like InfoSec researchers who like a lot of like malware and samples and stuff are posted on, or exploits are posted on GitHub, and now with Microsoft buying them, like Microsoft is tons of exploits about them. Are they going to censor, force GitHub to censor that?
Well, I don't know, but here's a story from Boing Boing, which came out recently. Back in January, Microsoft announced they were proud to support ICE. Honestly, what company would not be? A U.S. federal contract, no matter how large your coffers and corporate reach might be, is a good get, due both to the amount of American money that you'll pocket and the visuals that come from being okay, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not January anymore, and Microsoft in June 2018 is looking a lot like IBM back in the 1930s. I'll leave you to interpret that reference. Under the Trump administration's direction, ICE and other homeland security entities have been busy breaking up families, emotionally scarring thousands of innocent kids, driving their anguished caretakers into cages or worse, to suicide. Now, according to Gizmodo, a number of Microsoft employees who prefer to remain anonymous in the interest of protecting their careers have stepped forward to report that the computer technology company's relationship with ICE has led to growing dissent among the company's workforce. And that's something that, you know, we're going to see more and more of in the tech industry, people stepping up saying, I'm not comfortable with your position here.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft has massive government contracts. And I mean, to say that this is a Microsoft medium GitHub thing, like, hello. I mean, you think that they just care all of a sudden because Microsoft's prerogative is not to sell you mixed reality crap for the next 10 years? I mean, I'm pretty sure that they got a little bit of a phone call, maybe a little email, you know, a little courier from the government saying, hey, we got a thing here. Are you guys riding with us or not? And they're like, oh, yes, I'm sorry. We're your lapdog, whatever. But like, I don't think it was some sort of internal altruism that Microsoft just happened to, you know, pull out of nowhere.
I think this works as a transitional type of music. Is that what you had in mind, Deb, when you made this?
I don't know what I had in mind when I made this.
Like, yeah, that's the best kind, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like this. I like this bassy feel to it right now, because you know from playing this music that we're going to go to the phones now. And you know that the phone number is 347-335-0818. Come and join the conversation here on Off the Hook and share your point of view with us and tell us why we're wrong, because we love to hear that all the time.
Well, you know, speaking of
not
of
you,
that,
Alex, don't tell us what we're wrong.
Yeah. I think, you know, we're laying a little bit of blame here on the foot of Microsoft when, yeah. You got to remember, they're a corporation. They're responsible to their shareholders. They're not going to say no to a gigantic government contract.
Absolutely. Absolutely not. That's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't think it's squarely with them. I think they have pressure because of their interests, their own self-interest, but also externalities and, you know, bureaucratic, et cetera.
Well, you know, people, employees, they also have, you know, have obligations to humanity to speak up and to their conscience to speak up. So,
well, that's right.
I think that's what they're doing.
And, you know, and you know, this, you know, goes to the issue of, you know, whistleblowing lines in the United States, you know, for employees to blow the whistle on unethical business practices of a particular organization, which we don't necessarily have by law in the United States. And when I was chief compliance officer of a gigantic conglomerate in Europe, I was in charge of manning the worldwide whistleblowing line. And, you know, this is something that's mandated in the EU. And we could really learn a lot from that particular practice. And it could give employees a voice, a way to express their dissent internally without having to, let's say, dox a whole bunch of people that they may or may not have, you know, any involvement in a particular project.
All right. Well, our phone line remains open, 347-335-0818. One day I'll be able to memorize that phone number. We have a couple of other news stories that have appeared on our radar. Here's one. Four things that put you at risk online, according to a hacker. Yes, not kidding here. It's almost impossible to avoid being hacked if someone really wants to do it. But the idea is to make it hard enough that they'll skip over you and go for some other schmuck who's easier to hack. I love the articles people send us. Someone talked to an actual hacker about things people do that put them at risk online. An actual hacker. So this person talked to an actual hacker. Okay, here are four big ones. One, not changing your password regularly. You've probably heard it a million times, but it's that important. If you've been using the same password for 5 years, change it, especially if you use the same one across multiple websites. And here are some suggestions on passwords you can use. And it goes on into...
What about if you're using your friend's password?
Wait a minute. A, B, C, D, E, F. No. posting a photo of your house key. Yeah, we all do that. Some people do this to celebrate after they get a new place. Have you ever moved into a new place and say, hey, I'm going to celebrate by taking a picture of my key and posting that on the internet?
Hopefully I don't get robbed here.
I've seen that. I have really? Seen that. Yeah, I've seen people dangle their keys, you know, with a nice artistic shot of their, you know, ranch home on Long Island.
Did they work for ICE, these people that did this?
I don't think so.
Wow.
I don't think so, but
hey,
it's possible.
If you do work for ICE, though, dangle the ICE main office key and yes. Put that online. I dare you. All right. But hackers can use that photo to make a copy of your key and break in. Only hackers can do that. Burglars can't, because hackers are the ones responsible for all the bad in the world. If the photo is geotagged, they can find out exactly where you live. And if you don't know what that means, you're already doomed. Number three, you're a teenager posting a photo of their new driver's license. Now, Dent, you're a teenager.
Dang it.
Oh, God.
Have you posted your new driver's license up on the internet for all to see?
Nah, I'm just going to stick to the subway.
Well, you could take a picture of your Metro card, I guess.
Yeah, Metro cards are good. I think that will work.
As dumb as it sounds, this happens all the time. Hackers can use it to steal their identity, or steal your teenager's identity, or go after you since you're the one with the money. Wow, they really get into our brains, don't they? That's how we think. Okay, and finally, number four, not looking at what's in the background of photos before you post them, like taking a selfie at your desk. And not realizing your passwords are taped up behind you. Hey, how about this? Don't tape your passwords up behind you, regardless of whether or not you're taking a selfie. That's a stupid thing to do.
This is like a list of my attitude towards social media for like 10 years.
Also, be careful about things like paychecks and what's on your computer screen. Yeah, I guess you don't want to take a picture of your paycheck if you're taking a selfie.
Pictures are 1,000 words. People got to remember that. They get a little careless, you know. They think their group is just their friendly little group.
And that came from a site called Valdo's... Valdosta Today? I don't know what that means. .com. But thank you. Thank you, people, for sending that in. Let's take a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I saw this merger between Microsoft and GitHub, or Microsoft buying GitHub the other week, and it really confused me. I know this isn't a finance show, but does anybody know how GitHub actually makes money and why Microsoft would want to buy them? Because that's kind of like the reason why companies buy other companies.
You know, I ask that kind of question all the time. Like, how, you know, why did AT&T want Time Warner? What's in it for them? Volta, you have a theory?
Yeah, they do make some money by having premium features such as like private repos and event collaboration features for businesses. This is largely a defensive move for Microsoft. Like, if Google, like, as an entity, GitHub would not have been able to survive by itself because like, it doesn't get enough income through those services. But like as part of a larger organization, it helps them like with their strategy with attracting developers and stuff.
Yeah, and this also is a change in the way Microsoft looks at open source technology, particularly like the switch towards Linux and other platforms than the sort of historical thing Microsoft is known for, which is proprietary software and closed systems and so on and so forth. A lot of their enterprise stuff, a lot of their cloud and all this mixed reality, whatever their future is, they know firmly, very, very well, that it is not going to exist without open source technology. And GitHub is a huge, huge development platform that a lot of people use, especially open source projects.
Does that help to answer your question, sir?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've used GitHub to post stuff and certainly download other things, and I've never been asked to pay anything by the company, but to me, I really see it more as insidious to sort of stop development rather than foster it. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It definitely could be used to guide development, and then that's something to watch, much like we're watching ownership in consolidation of media corporations, for instance.
That's why it's always such a good thing to remain independent whenever it's possible.
I mean, to make a contrary point, if they were going to use this to really cease or halt some kind of development or collaboration for open source and whatnot, people would just find another medium. Somebody would create another repository, and perhaps that's what people are going to do anyway.
But sadly, there is a network effect because GitHub is not just the Git protocol. It's all the social features and commenting. It's a social network, basically. So with network effects, those are de facto monopolies, and it's very difficult to escape those.
Thanks for that phone call, 347-335-0818, if anybody else is out there has questions or comments. Here's something that is another story someone sent us off the nextweb.com. I love these sites. The word hack is meaningless and should be retired. Yes, the word hack used to mean something, and hackers were known for their technical brilliance and creativity. And now literally anything is a hack. Anything, to the point where the term is meaningless and should be retired. The most egregious abuse of the term hack comes from the BBC's Dougal Shaw. I think this is a British site, so I won't know half the references. In a recent video of his called My Lunch Hack, Shaw demonstrates that it's cheaper to make your own sandwich each day than it is to buy a prepackaged sandwich from the supermarket. Wow. Well, you know what? That's good enough to qualify for Hack of the Week. No, it's not. It really is not. Let's continue with this story here. He calls that a hack. I call it common sense. That's not nearly the worst example. I haven't touched on life hacks yet. And you know what? We don't have time to touch on life hacks because there were just so many crazy examples here. Okay, yeah. Turning a Pepsi can into a key ring is cool. It's a stretch to call it a hack. There's all sorts of abuses of the word.
There's honestly, as much as this might not be popular, we understand what you're saying, but there really isn't a barrier for entry to call something a hack. I don't think that, you know, yeah, it's really about the spirit of hacking, and I think a lot of these ideas embody that and it are exemplatory of that. But it's not something that we would be quick to say you have to be able to do X to be considered Y. And I don't think any hacker anywhere would agree, you know. Or
well, this article ends. I regret to inform you the word hack is now bad and should be avoided. What to replace it with, I'm not sure. Thank you, Matthew Hughes, for writing that article and coming up with no suggestion on what to replace the word with. But people have been talking about this since the 80s. You know, hacking is abused. What should the word be replaced with? And no one has a good solution for this. Hey, by the way, just so people aren't confused, that bit of music we played is not one of Dents. So yeah. I don't want people to be confused by that. We do have a couple more pieces that we're going to play. But we also have somebody on the phone. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hello. Okay. The GitHub is not on the stock market yet, so and they don't expect an IPO for quite a while. So
never.
I imagine Microsoft is doing exactly what somebody just said about it being a defensive move to kind of gobble them up before they cause any damage to Microsoft. So that's one thing. I was going to grab a few shares if they were on the big board or the Nasdaq, but. They're not there yet. So
see,
anyway,
the thing is, like, when something like this happens, what stops people from just starting something else that's independent? You know, if you don't like where Twitter is going, have a different social media network. I'm sorry?
Network effects. Like, there are things like Mastodon.social, you can host your own, like, Twitter alternative and federate them. But, like, because it's, like, a collective action problem of everybody transitioning to that new service. Like, we've been talking forever about, oh, what's the new open source Facebook going to be? Is it going to be Diaspora? Is it going to be something, status.net? None of these have – they're great from a technical perspective, but there's a collective action problem of getting all your friends to transition at once.
It's about establishing critical mass. That's why Facebook is now in the position it is. And, you know, if it was MySpace, they would be the ones, in, you know, testifying.
See, I don't understand why things like Facebook are popular in the first place. Every time I go onto Facebook, I wind up shouting and being upset at something. Mostly the interface, but a lot of times the people.
They're popular because they have the people, like, which...
Yeah, I know.
And from a technical perspective, they have awful user interface and stuff. But
terrible user interface. I never could understand the allure of that. Hey, we have another Dent piece here. Tell us what was going through your mind when you made this one.
Just adding reverb to different instruments and seeing what it sounded like and building on it.
Wow. Very, very cool. Do you have advice? I'm sure there's a lot of listeners right now, probably a lot of young listeners who are experimenting with music and trying to get started. Anything you could tell them that might encourage them to keep going?
Yeah, when I started...
Sorry, the music's too loud over you. I'm going to turn you down a little bit. There you go.
When I started producing, I spent a lot of time getting frustrated because I couldn't make it sound exactly the way I wanted to. And so that stopped me for a while from continuing. But my advice would be to just keep going and revisit the old stuff later once you've acquired the skills to perfect it.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, does it ever wind up exactly where you expected it to wind up?
Not really.
That's a good thing, though, right? Isn't that a good thing? When
it is a good thing. Sometimes you'll be happy with it, and then you'll listen to it the next day, and you'll hate it. So,
but don't ever erase it.
Yeah, don't. That's the key thing. Don't delete your old stuff.
Yeah,
back it all up.
You know, there's so many parallels with writing. You know, I tell people all the time. You know, you're better off writing, even if it doesn't get printed someplace, than not writing, because you will always have something that way. And always hold on to your early works because you learn so much about yourself.
This stuff is really fantastic. Dent, is there some place where our listeners could go to find more of your music, perhaps?
Well, definitely a Hope Conference. That's one
That's
place
true.
To go.
Yes, you but can apart find from that. It at Hope, and I'm also on SoundCloud. I post all my half-finished stuff up there. So if you want to check it out, it's soundcloud.com/sadvibesonly.
Sad vibes only, but they're not just sad vibes. They're happy
not.
Vibes. They're
yeah. There's lots of different vibes.
I think it's ironic.
We'll post a link to that on our Twitter page, which is Hacker Radio Show on Twitter.
That's right. You can tweet to us, Hacker Radio Show on Twitter. You can write to us, OTH@2600.com. That's our email address. We love to hear from our listeners and send us stories. Send us. Tales of woe or tales of triumph that you personally have experienced, suggestions, feedback of all sorts. This reminder again, coming up tomorrow on Hope.net webpage, we will be announcing our speaker lineup, most of our speaker lineup. There are still a few more that we're working out, but you'll see just the amazing lineup that we have for the Hope Conference coming up. And someone told me today the hotel was sold out. I'm not sure if the hotel is sold out. You might want to check into that by following the links that are also on that page for special deals and all that kind of thing. So it's happening. It's a month away. Literally a month from today is when it begins. Think about that.
Whoa.
Oh, my God. I am not ready. I am so not ready. All right. We're going to go out with one more piece, Dent. Walter, you had something?
Oh, I wish everybody a happy Pride.
Oh, yes. Happy Pride. Absolutely. This is the final piece. It's only a minute 24, so we're going to have to get out of here quickly. But anything you want to tell us about this piece before I hit the button?
I made this. This was one of the first ones I made. I named them all chronologically. So this was, I think, Dope Beat 8.
Dope Beat 8. Dot Wave. Yes. Right.
Yeah, so it's an oldie, but
uh-huh.
I vaguely remember the creative process.
Okay. Well, again, Dent's music will be featured prominently at the conference in between every single talk. So you'll find yourself walking to the beat and hopefully walking at a good pace because we really need to move people from room to room. We'll be back next week at this. Well, at the same time, we'll be leaving. But next week, an hour earlier, we'll be here. We would very much like you to join us then. And that's going to do it for us here on this particular edition of Off the Hook. Stay tuned for the Personal Commuter Show. Good night.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI in New York. Enjoy.
Today is June 20th, 2018. Tomorrow is the first day of summer. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are slightly different. Highly sensitive encrypted email at risk of exposure. PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy, is an encryption program that provides cryptographic privacy and authentication for data communication. It was developed by Phil Zimmerman back in 1991. PGP generates a public key to encrypt messages and a private key to decrypt messages. OpenPGP is an email encryption standard. A newfound flaw in email clients that use PGP and S/MIME to encrypt messages can be exploited to expose the plain text of the missive. According to a paper published by a team of researchers from three European universities, by injecting malicious snippets of text into encrypted messages, attackers can use the flaw to make the email client exfiltrate decrypted copies of the emails. Malicious actions is triggered as soon as a recipient opens a single crafted email from an attacker. The software defect was found in 23 of 35 S/MIME clients and in 10 of 28 PGP clients tested. Example of what is a PG client? Thunderbird, Apple Mail, Open Keychain, Android Privacy Guard, TrueCrypt, BitLocker, and many others. While it is necessary to change the OpenPGP and S/MIME standards to fix these vulnerabilities, some clients had even more severe implementation flaws, allowing straightforward exfiltration of the plain text. Phil Zimmerman noted that although the issue is serious, it has to do more with buggy clients at the host than with OpenPGP. Some email clients fail to use the encryption protocol's native features to stymie the kind of attack described by the researchers. There's some checking that goes on in PGP, but if the email client reacts to the news delivered by PGP that something has been hampered with, then everything will be okay. But if the client ignores that information, then you get this vulnerability. A patch to address the flaw already has been made for the Thunderbird email client, but not yet for Apple Mail. The patch doesn't close the vulnerability, it just makes it impossible to exploit it on a client. Emails that are sent from a client are still exploitable. It fixes the receiving end of the vulnerability, but it doesn't fix the underlying vulnerability in the protocol, which remains. When that underlying problem is fixed, it likely won't be backward compatible. Since only a small percentage of email users employ a PGP or S/MIME client, the threat the flaw poses to all users isn't as severe as it could be. However, it is extremely severe for the vulnerable users and their correspondents, as this threat offers a way for an attacker to access clear text content of communication meant to be secure. Of the more than 3 billion email users in the world, only tens of millions use PGP mail. Those that use it, however, are people like journalists, system administrators, and at big companies. So the type of information that is sent via PGP is usually the most sensitive. It needs to be secure. Adding to the severity of the attack is its ability to access past emails. The victim's mail client can be used as a tool to decrypt old emails that have been sent or received, and that's pretty bad. That's pretty severe. For users concerned about the security of their PGP or S/MIME email clients, well, stop using the vulnerable email clients to decrypt emails. Use a standalone application. Disable HTML rendering and automatic remote content in your email client. This will block the back-channel communication mechanism
used by the flaw to infiltrate clear text data. Look for updates. It is expected that vendors will issue patches to correct some of the flaws exposed by the researchers.
This was covered a few weeks ago, but it is worth repeating. There is a website, www.haveibeenpwned.com. You enter your email address and it will determine what dark web group may have your email address. You can also enter your password. The entry itself is encrypted and it will check to see if the password is in the library stored in the dark web. If it exists in the dark web, change the password and make sure it is unique. The dark web has this massive library of passwords that is used for brute force hacking.
On June 7th, less than 2 weeks ago, Sprint was offering an unlimited plan for $15 if you were porting each line from another carrier. Sprint's offer was for unlimited data, calling, and texting. Sprint was hoping to draw attention when it introduced promotion to lure customers from Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile. It worked. It worked so well, it was ended in less than a week. Sprint ended the $15 per month unlimited promotion plan June 13th, and Sprint would not comment on how many people have taken advantage of the promotion. Those who have gotten into the promotion or who signed up before it expired will be able to keep the $15 per month rate. Not to be outdone, AT&T raised the price of grandfathered unlimited plans to $45. Hey, I thought competition resulted in lower prices, not raising prices. Well, and now we've heard from Verizon. They offered a new pricier unlimited plan with even more high-speed data. The carrier also let you mix and match different unlimited data options within the same family plan. But the way Verizon has explained it, it muddled the definition of the word unlimited. They introduced a third more expensive tier titled Above Unlimited. This comes on top of Go Unlimited and Beyond Unlimited with varying degrees of, well, different features. The nation's largest wireless carrier is also shaking up how you choose your plan, allowing you to mix and match different tiers within the same family plan. It's an acknowledgement that not everyone in the family has the same wireless needs. The result is a lot more options for customer, if not more confusion. Ronan Dunn, the president of Verizon Wireless, said, "It's very simple. We're confident people will enjoy the choice." Well, how do the new plans work? For your reference, here's a breakdown of all the plans, as best as I can understand it. Note that the prices and details for the first two tiers haven't really changed. Starting with Go Unlimited, the lowest tier, which includes unlimited data, but streaming video and mobile hotspot speeds at 600 kilobits per second, which is slow. Prices range from $40 to $75 per line, depending on the number of lines. Next step up is Beyond Unlimited. And Beyond Unlimited is high-definition video for up to 22 gigabytes before Verizon will throttle you, and the mobile hotspot speed is up to 15 gigabytes of usage. Price range from $50 to $85 per line. And then the top of the line Above Unlimited. The new plan includes unlimited data with high-definition video for up to 75 gigabytes before Verizon starts throttling you, as well as 20 gigabytes of mobile hotspot data at LTE speeds. And then there are 5 travel passes, with each offers a day of international data usage per month and 500 gigabytes of Verizon cloud service. Prices range from $60 to $95 per line. Well, when you say prices range per line, well, how does it range? Verizon's new phone plan proves that it has no idea what the word unlimited really means. Wireless carriers have already demonstrated an inability to understand what unlimited actually means, offering phone plans that habitually throttle customers who use more than 26 gigabytes or so of data every month. However, with the release of the Above Unlimited plan, Verizon is pushing the mental gymnastics that carrier employed to define the word unlimited to a different level of definition. Beyond Unlimited plan is their top of 22 gigabytes of data,
and at a lot slower speed. Above the unlimited plan is the 75 gigabytes of unlimited data per month, along with 20 gigabytes of unlimited data when using your phone as a hotspot, and 5 monthly international travel passes, which are daily vouchers, and 5 monthly international travel passes, which are daily vouchers that let you use your phone's wireless service abroad, the same as if you were in the United States. And if that wasn't bad enough, Verizon has also updated its convoluted sliding prices scheme to adjust based on how many phone lines are on a single bill. For instance, families with 4 lines of service, the above unlimited cost is $60 per person. But if you're the